so-called contemporary services out there. We've been watching this trend for the last 3 or 4 years, and I think it's starting to shift. So I still don't know what it is.
When you say shift?
Well, people have gotten hold of this vocabulary from someplace, and it hasn't come from our office. But it's contemporary services or alternative. And we've been doing surveys with congregations trying to find out what it is they mean when they say they're doing contemporary worship. And basically, there is no pattern. It's just a vocabulary term that people have gotten a hold of.
It's a junk term for anything not in the LBW.
Yeah, basically, it's anything, you're right, anything that's not in the LBW, which really is, in terms of our analysis, is not very helpful. You know, one person's contemporary is another person's traditional is another. It's a really a meaningless term, so we try not to use it. We're more concerned with the content of any service. You know, I'll ask the congregation, what are you doing? I'll keep asking more and more questions. Not to say, you know, we're doing a contemporary service. I'll say, what does that mean? Oh, well, we use the green book instead of the red book. Oh, really? Is that what you mean? Or we use with one voice is an answer we get. Or we use the hymnal supper. Usually has to do with some kind of musical setting that's not in the Lutheran Book of Worship. So, and that's, there's no problem with that. There's no problem with that. We've got 4 or 5 worship books in the ELCA now that are ours. So whether congregations use the green one or the blue one or the Spanish one or the new African American one or what have you, doesn't change anything about the fact that they're doing Lutheran worship. It's just what setting they happen to use them, and there's lots of settings available these days. It's almost too much out there. People are starting to get overloaded with all these different choices. And a lot of questions we get about how to navigate through the choices rather than, you know, let's do contemporary this or that. It's like, what do we do with all this stuff that we have? And how do we, you know, have a craft of worship life for our congregation that's appropriate with all the available resources that are out there for us to use, and weeding through them all. So it's kind of planning is what we get questions about these days.
What's the focus? What do you see as the focus of your job or your office right now? You mean sort of things you want to get done?
Well, technically, we are supposed to be resourcing congregations in worship. That's what we're charged to do.
Surveying,
we do all kinds of diagnostics, as we would call it, to see what congregations are doing. That's why I always like to come to these things and ask people questions. And rather than kind of giving answers, I prefer to listen and see what's going on. Because if we don't know what's going on in the parishes, we can't really help in terms of developing resources, which is another thing we spend a lot of time doing, developing new materials for the church.
What's in the works that's new?
What's in the works? Well, the big thing that I'm working on right now, I'm trying to bring to birth, is a new African American worship book called This Far by Faith. It's due to be published next April, and I've been working on this for 5 years. And people on the committee have been working on this for 5 years. So look forward to that being published. There's a, I don't know, contemporary songbook, whatever that means. I wanted to try to define it, but basically pop rock genre music, hymnal, songbook will be coming out from Miles Brook Fortress next, I believe, May. It doesn't even have a name yet, so I don't know what color it'll be, but it'll look something like One Voice in terms of its size. And that's been on a fast timeline. It's only been in development for 2 years, and will be out next year. We just published a Spanish book a couple months ago, El Libro de Liturgia y Cántico, Book of Liturgy and Song. And it's out there, it can be bought. And it's 30% of the things in there are bilingual. So even non-speaking, Spanish-speaking congregations could find it useful, especially for choir repertoires. And except 30% of the music can be sung in English or Spanish and have both lines there, so that book's now available and it's beginning to filter into the church very slowly. And those hold it doesn't have it yet. But hold is the kind of place that if something's new, they'll get a hold of it. So I'm wondering when it's going to show up in the holding book stack. So maybe next year I might come back, it'll be there. As well as the new, I don't know, they'll come to buy some of the books, but we've got 2 coming out next year. I'm really excited about that.
maybe the other people here could plug into this, but I'm interested in knowing whether church, their church is a separate traditional and folk alternative services, or did it kind of blend them together?
That's quite a town.
And how would it work? If they're separate, I think you tend to separate the congregation.
So who has different services?
I could talk about my congregation. I have a congregation in Minneapolis. And it's called Our Savior's Lutheran Church. And it's very diverse, very unique.
It's really.
Just a really, does anyone know Mary Preuss?
Yeah.
Remember that name?
Tom White, yeah.
Yeah, she's, Mary Preuss is the music director at Our Savior's Lutheran Church.
Wow.
And she just really puts a lot of incredible energy into it. And we tend to combine traditional and contemporary. I mean, we don't even use those terms, traditional and contemporary. We just sort of throw in music and there it is. You know, it's really, we could be singing "My Fortress Is Our God" and "Sana Sananina," you know, in the same service, which is I think that's an African spiritual. We combine ours.
Do you have one or two services?
We have two services, but they're the same.
The same. Mm-hmm. That's the matter.
Yeah. We don't. They don't do them differently. To my knowledge.
And that's going well.
Oh yeah, it's going really well. And I think having the good blend has really helped. I think sometimes it's for people who tend to be on the more traditional side of things. It's been a nice gradual integration of new things. It's not letting things become sort of stagnant, but you know, integrating new things into what you're doing and how you worship. It's been really smooth, I think. And it's helped draw in, I mean, this is an inner city church. It's helped, that attitude has sort of helped draw in a lot of diversity, you know, from all perspectives, whether it be, you know, sexual orientation, ethnicity, whatever.
It sounds like churches I go to in cities. I find this contemporary traditional is a suburban phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of the churches so I visit in Chicago, like my church, where I go occasionally when I'm in town, which isn't too often. It's a small inner city church, and we have a half-time pastor. It's in a neighborhood with a lot of young professionals, artists, a lot of gay people. It's a very diverse city community. We have one service, and they use LBW, and they use With One Voice, and they use the hymnal supplement. And that's just the typical norm of a city church. And a lot of them don't have two services, so it's not a matter of choosing, you know, which one will be what. I mean, it's just, and I see that a lot in city churches. I don't see this, as I said, I see this multiple service thing. It almost assumes a certain size congregation where you can't have multiple services in the first place. A lot of city churches have one service. Or rural churches too, and that's the majority of our church. Like we're a 60% rural congregation church, and our average congregation size is 500 in the ELC. But a lot of what you hear is based on churches with thousands and so four pastors and four services, different flavors.
How big a church would you say that typically, how large would a church be typically that has two services? More than
that. I don't know these statistics really well, how evangelism people know them like that. I'd say about 700 or 800 before they even talking about two services. There's something they have these lists of plateaus, the congregations go to in terms of membership. And there's a certain size you get to where you have to hire the second pastor or you add the second service, and it's around between 700 and 1,000 where congregations start doing that.
Well, I see it a little differently on the size thing. I go to All Saints, and there they have two services, one traditional and the first service. The second service, they have experimenting with new stuff, and I just don't like that new one, although it's always
use?
Has more people
in
it. So I go to the older one, so I think perhaps the judgment of services may better be made on age and experience rather than sheer numbers.
Where is your church?
All Saints.
It's federally Washington area.
But that's the, you asked what we used for our second worship service, and there's been a volunteer group of people who have worked very, very hard, and they really pulled in a lot of their own material, and my feeling is, gosh, they go through so much work, why don't they just use something that's already prepared?
So they write their own music in terms of...
Yep.
They don't compose their own music, but they seek different songs out of different books, and they've gone to workshops to see which of them are most popular for this particular era. And now we've hired a new worship leader for that particular worship service.
Mm-hmm. And we're not that large a church, only 350?
Yes, it's more than
something like that.
Maybe like 400 confirmed.
Mm-hmm. 200 active.
Anybody else want to talk about prayer congregation?
We were even smaller, though. As soon as we moved into our first building, our pastor and council decided to go to two services to make worship more available to people at different times.
Mm-hmm. So are they both on Sunday or one's on Saturday?
Yeah, it's on Saturday, or Sunday at this point, though we did try Saturday night. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. And we always tried to...
Well, they did something really creative this year, and I think it really worked for Saturday, if they can come up with something like that. More of a concert kind of prayer worship thing.
Is it throughout the year or
we just tried it this summer for Saturday night.
And your location?
Like music in the park.
Yeah.
Were you looking? Where?
We're in, Clackamas, Oregon. But, and we've always tried to integrate, we have about 7 different liturgies, mm-hmm. and they're all traditional with different, like you say, just different musical backgrounds. And we realize this is not contemporary worship. So our worship and music committee is just starting to define what contemporary might mean for us and what that would look like. And we're starting to think maybe there'd be a place for a separate service that was different. If it appealed to, if it brought in people. I mean, that's our objective. We want people here. You know, we want them to hear the gospel. So we're just starting to look at whether or not a really different kind of service would really separate the church and divide us, or whether it would just help us to grow.
Well, statistics say that any service you add on your worship schedule will attract people. No matter when you add it, or what day, what time, or what style, doesn't make any difference. Any new worship service will attract a certain number of people. Some people just like to come in to the ground floor of something, just like a mission church. You can put a church across the street, you know, it's been there forever, and you put up a same congregation puts up a sign across the street in a building, people will come to it instead of going to the one that's been there. That's just the statistics prove that. So if you do want to bring more people in, you can start a new worship service. That's been proved.
Does that go the same for bars and things like that too?
I don't know.
That's true with fast food.
The same level, everybody.
You know, that's true with the fast foods. Building nature is something because the people will come one or the other. You know,
people feel they're coming to a church for the first time. Sometimes they're coming in when everybody else coming in new. They feel they're on the same level. It's not like there's people who have been here for 30 years and you have to navigate your way around all these things you don't know. And if everybody's new, then that draws people. It's like, maybe here's my chance to go to something. And it's just psychology, I think. But, so that definitely works.
But you also, I think, that you have to be careful to know if you're just trying anything just to get people in.
Yeah,
you know,
keep them there.
Yeah, you gotta be careful to make sure that you're also the core of the church, you know, the people who have, you know, started that church or whatever, but they're also pleased with the worship and are feeling like their needs are met in the worship, because otherwise they'll leave, and, you know, so.
That's why we just add something.
Yeah.
What does matin worship mean?
Matin?
Well, I thought you were to use that word.
Morning.
Hmm?
No, I didn't use that word.
Oh. Well. What word did you use?
If you add, I said something like, if you add too much, or if you don't use the, if you change your worship style too much just to bring new people in, then you might lose people that are the core of what you have already.
Well, actually, All Saints have worked on that basis. They've got the traditional service first, and it works great. I like that. But the second service, when I go to that, I just don't like it at all.
Yeah. What our church found out is that people that felt the way you do gradually started coming to the
alternative
service, and it's been really successful to have two different services that are in our congregation. And during the summer, they go to one service.
But alternate Sundays.
Yeah.
That's the format.
Why do you keep them people informed of what service is when? Need the newsletter.
So what do you do with your other service, with your alternate service?
We have musicians that we have like two guitars, trumpet that plays with a mute, two keyboards, a drum set that he's not there every week, but he's part of it too, and just a couple of vocalists. Mm-hmm. And somebody said to me when they first started this, they said, well, if I want to be entertained, I can go someplace else. And I said, I feel like I'm part of the heavenly choir, because they are harmonizing at the same time that we're singing. Can you tell I really love it? You know, I really, and the liturgy is, it's not from a book. It was written by our pastor, some of it, and the words, and then two familiar songs, like Edelweiss is one of the tunes. I knew I was going to be able to think of a tune. But it's from real familiar tunes, and yet it covers the confession and, you know, all the different aspects of the liturgy. And
that's a very old pattern.
I
love the confession.
Yeah. The hymnic liturgy originated with Martin Luther.
We had the alternative service first at 9 o'clock, and then the LBW service at 11. And I think it's difficult to tell how many people were there because they preferred the style of worship or because they liked the time. I think there were a lot of people that maybe would have preferred LBW, but gradually migrated to the earlier service because they were out at 10 versus.
And then the problem became, how do we get the 11 o'clock service to be interesting, because it just
dwindled down to about 30 people.
Yeah.
Wednesday after Sunday.
What church are you from? Small town?
Mount Vernon. About 60 miles north of Seattle.
I got a question that I might have missed, but what constitutes the minimum format to be called a church service?
The minimum number of people or the minimum...
Format.
Okay.
Content.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that in the book, the Olympic voice, identifies the mandatory parts of the service?
Well, part of the problem that the older folks had is that the book that was chosen, I don't think it's a Lutheran book. We call it the red book. But it's like you have to maybe sometimes turn two pages on the same song, and it's the way, it was probably cheap or something, but it's the way the songbook is laid out that for some of the people who are used to singing more slowly or more traditional things, they've had a hard time.
It's harder to follow.
They don't complain about the service, at least that I hear so much, but they complain about the book.
Mm-hmm. And that's just the hymns.
Liturgy
is
printed.
Yeah.
You said the opening, the services as far as time? Or?
Well, just for the summer now, when we're just having one service for the summer, then we alternate format. Every other Sunday is alternate, and every other Sunday is traditional.
Mm-hmm. Now, to depend on what I said, sometimes we have, for quite a while, All Saints, they had communion every Sunday, but now they've changed that. They don't have it every Sunday, about once a month now.
No, once or 2 weeks.
That's very unusual. Wow. Church.
That's every week.
It's going against the trends.
Yeah. What's the trend?
Towards weekly Eucharist. Mm-hmm. Increases where, that's where we would like to be. That's what all of our documents state, but the trend, we watch statistics every year. We're about 60% now. A lot of congregations with multiple services, where they tend to have communion at least one of the services. Mm-hmm. So you do have a weekly Eucharist, even though it may be at one of four services. But
but that's a trend in most of the mainline churches anyway.
Found that, you know, when you said Mary Price, in our church we had a woman that when we started alternative worship, she was very into what worship is, you know, about. So she provided a structure that always had very meaningful structure, and she went off on different types of music and so on, and different confessions and so on, and she left to Alaska. So then the group decided that they would do it. Well, they were trendy. They didn't own worship. And then we had a little bit of conflict or a confrontation because the service got cute rather than a worship service. You know, I like this hymn, and well, take out this, and you know, and all of a sudden, you know, at a certain period of time, about 2 months, people were uncomfortable. Something was missing. They didn't know what was missing, but they felt that.
Yeah, people don't like to be kept off balance.
That's right, and you know, the there was a structure. So I think, you know, what I'm getting at is when you're doing alternative to worship, the leadership is very key and who's planning it. It's not just we need something different. And I've seen that in some parishes rather than what is the alternative and what's the goal and how can we handle this in a worshipful, meaningful way.
In regard to that, if you hire a person and you know they have so much leeway in choosing music and everything, and what if it becomes more and more what Lutherans don't particularly like, or how do you handle it? Is it the worship and music committees, or the committee that's doing the contemporary worship, or do you just let people mumble under their breath? Mm-hmm. How did your church handle it?
Well, you know, I think first of all, before you hire a person, you got to set out guidelines or a structure in which you feel that, you know, on place. It's not their freewheeling, you know. And then they provide the structure, and then whoever it is a staff member or the board or something that's controlling what is going on. Not individuals in the congregation. There's got to be some structural form.
Somebody is.
That handles what's going on. Because if you get a vote or, oh, they like this, you know, and that, you know, that becomes a mess.
We've got a worship committee that meets every month, if not more frequently than that, and that helps keep things kind of on task and making sure that, you know, members of the congregation, their needs are being met.
Yeah.
Yeah. Encourage committees start to work, especially the work.
Yeah.
And work hard.
They do.
Any other
issues? I'd like to ask about my church is moving to weekly communion, which is a big deal.
Yeah, it's amazing how big a deal.
And I wonder how others have handled the great resistance and hostility towards the Eucharist. It's been really, I've been so appalled that there's all this sort of hostility towards the Eucharist.
Well, people,
because they're supposed to be special, you know.
Yeah, that's a whole piety that's been very alive in the church.
People are faithful to what they've been taught.
You can be sure. It's quite a shift for a congregation that's been, like I said, people are very faithful to what they've been taught. And a lot of people have been raised under a piety that's, I don't want to say it's reformed. I mean, the reformed churches are moving towards the weekly Eucharist. But kind of getting away from both Luther and Calvin's desire, which was for weekly communion. So I don't want to put it on the Presbyterians that are friends.
We're
in the same boat. But both of our traditions come, with weekly Eucharist as a part of that. Even the Methodists too, but somehow coming to the American shores and being influenced by other traditions, maybe Anabaptist traditions, which are more of the kind of the quarterly communion, which is a dominant tradition in the United States, that kind of a religious tradition, which isn't the classical Reformation, which the Presbyterians and the Lutherans and the Methodists, like come out of. We've been more influenced by our contacts than we have been by our own theological tradition, and trying to recover our own heritage in a country was influenced by another religious tradition is very difficult. So just trying to recover that now, trying to bring out the teachings of Luther and Calvin and Wesley. And it's starting to take hold, at least in our church. Like I said, the percentage of weekly Eucharist goes up. But people have been raised with a certain kind of piety around infrequent Eucharist. And that's, for them, that's the norm. And you may not be able to change those people's minds. But what you can do is to work with congregations. So think about it from the perspective of the person sitting next to you. Maybe your piety is that you don't want to receive Eucharist because of whatever you've been taught about it being special or what have you. And that's fine. The goal of the weekly communion is not to force people to commune, it's to offer weekly communion for the church. People can participate if they want to. They're free not to receive, but if there is no weekly Eucharist, those who want weekly Eucharist are deprived of it. So to have weekly communion doesn't mean everyone has to participate. Can receive, they can sit and sing. That's no problem. If you don't have it, you're people who don't want, I do not go to church without communion. I just have to go to church without finding communion. Because I would feel totally lost.
But that discounts the herd factor, too. And I mean, we did that, the herd factor, that, I'm not just going to sit there while other people are going.
Right. But so we have it. We should base our, what do you base your positions on?
So, I've been to this one church where their communion was held after the main service,
To
put it that way. So if you chose to have communion, you stayed.
That's an Anabaptist tradition. That is totally outside Lutheran theological tradition. Where communion is like, I would say for our church, no. I mean, congregations can do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they can do whatever they want to, but that doesn't mean that that's the approved position of our church. Because we've always maintained word and sacrament as belonging together and equal and not even just equal, but of part and parcel of the same reality, theologically, even though we may have lost that in practice, but that's always been our position, that the sacrament is the visible word, and it's not of any less weight than the word. And to have it after kind of takes it to a secondary position, which theologically we have never, ever stated in this church, and most of the men in the church.
I'm interested, your church, that's the first church I've heard that had four weeks, every communion every Sunday and then went back to communion once a month. Why?
He missed four.
You've always had it every second.
We've never had communion every week.
Oh, you've
always had it every second.
We've had it every other week.
Oh, okay.
We've gone from a gradual, about 10 years ago, the pattern used to be once a month pretty much for the majority, and then it went to every other Sunday, which is a very interesting pattern, because once you get to that point, then you're gone. I mean, you're going to switch eventually, because then you start to see what is the reason for skipping. There is no theological logic to it. if there isn't, you can't come up with a theological justification for having, it's not some kind of a, you know, the moon rising on this Sunday and on the other, or there's no reason for it. So you have to be confronted with, why do we have Eucharist? What's Eucharist about? And then you get to the frequency thing will come along, but then you start, well, why do we skip this Sunday?
Sometimes it's person power, you know, it seems like a fairly simple thing for, to prepare the altar and all that, but it still takes a number of people.
Sure. So that's the church, purpose of church is to be a church.
Sure.
One way that when we switched over to doing it every week, we sort of looked at it as an outreach sort of thing, and that because we were having a lot of people, we were in the inner city, so there are a lot of people who just kind of wander in off the streets, you know, and maybe they wanted to partake, maybe they're Christians, and they wanted to partake of communion, and we wanted to provide that opportunity. So it was hard at first, but that was the way we kind of thought about it, was, oh, it's an outreach sort of thing. That's for someone who may not.
It's interesting that a lot of churches that say they have contemporary services, those services have a higher percentage of communion than the so-called traditional services. We've done those comparisons.
Our traditional's first and third. I promise we'd never change that until a certain generation died. And some people
have, yeah, more of the so-called contemporary services have Eucharist on a regular basis than the so-called traditional. It's very interesting. And a lot of pastors talk about outreach. And that's interesting, but it's like, well, do you believe it's outreach for the visitor? Should be outreach for the members, as Luther said, about what communion is receiving God. So it's good for visitors, it's also good for the members.
Luther's way of witnessing, so
yeah. It's God witnessing, it's not just us witnessing to somebody else, it's God witnessing to us, according to our theology.
So
it's for you, given for you. It's God to us, not the other way around. So.
I think the congregation will start to feel the unifying, forgiving, family thing that all comes with the Eucharist, that's the center of our worship.
So it takes a while to move to get past that every other Sunday. That's the hard barrier.
So we're talking about Sunday services. How about other? Is the church large or the home church and main office? What's the perspective on other services, funerals, weddings, and the like?
In terms of Eucharist?
Yeah. Desirable, preferred?
Well, yeah. It's related to the life of a Christian. Mm-hmm. We try to talk about having Eucharist during weddings, or having marriages during the main service, whatever that is, Sunday or Saturday or what have you. Same for funeral. We don't have any rules about this, of course, but in the context, you know, of doing something for a baptized Christian, it only makes sense to a certain extent that Eucharist might be a part of that. It's kind of goes with the whole package. Baptism and passage.
And some of the same things that we've been talking about apply to when you decide that you're going to lower the age for for Eucharist.
That's interesting. That's something I'd like to hear from you about your age for First Communion. You know what that is in your church, and whether it's shifting anyway.
We're attempting to. There's been a survey, and in the next newsletter, the pastor will have a questionnaire. But there's, I guess I don't have a real feel, except one woman who said, and she's kind of angry about it.
Okay. Do you all know about the new sacramental practices statement of the church? We have a new statement on sacramental practices.
Thank you.
The ELCA assembly representing you folks. This is our highest legislative authority in the ELCA as the churchwide assembly, not the church council. But in 1997 in Philadelphia, they approved this new statement on sacramental practices. And I guess one of the new things about the statement is it took away a line from the old 78 statement which said infant communion is precluded. That line from the 78 statement is no longer there, which means, in theory, Lutheran congregations in good conscience may commune the baptized if they so choose.
What's the standard here? I mean, ours is whenever the pastor and the parents believe the child.
It's totally shifting now. But the age of First Communion has been steadily going down in the church for the last 10 years.
So, but does the church shift, or do they just do, I mean, we just went the, when parents think the kid's ready?
Yeah, churches are going through big stuff. That's why we started to talk about this for sacramental practices anyway. Because we got into quandaries. Bishops were having problems in synods. Especially with mobility between people and congregations. Uh-huh. They would be at St. John's and Spokane, and they would have their kid communions in first grade, and then they moved to St. John's in Portland, and their policy is fifth grade. And the child who's been communing for 4 or 5 years in Spokane, all of a sudden is not supposed to be communing at the other church, and if they would allow that child to commune, then all the other children in the parish in Portland would say, hey, wait a minute, it's like, how do I can't? So it's beginning to be a problem when people go from congregation to congregation and they find totally different policies. And they're still going to find that now, but it's not going to be because of church-wide saying the age of First Communion is fifth grade, which used to be the kind of the norm. I think the last thing you said, the norm of fifth grade. But now there is no norm. That's been taken away. So each congregation has to decide.
Does that generate a lot of heat? I mean, that generated almost no heat for us.
Yeah, I mean, like the trend has been going downward and downward on its own without the church saying anything on it. So people have been deciding by themselves. There's not a lot of congregations that have infant communion yet. And like people like to make jokes about that, but I mean, the Orthodox have been doing it for a long time.
Well, what did they start?
Babies and
arms. Age 3?
Basically, parents and churches, the folk wisdom I've been hearing is basically when a child can eat solid food, congregations, some of them are allowing them. When the parents say it's okay to commune, whatever that means, could be.
What happens for the family or the child that time? Mm-hmm. You were in reference to early communion or first communion, whatever.
Yeah.
And usually there's an instruction.
Yes.
And early communion, mm-hmm. With each family is doing it in a different time. Is there a material or helps for the family to gather for that or not?
Yes. There's new resources being published. About 4 years ago, we published a resource called The Welcome Table from Augsburg, which is geared to first and second grade. Because we saw the trend was going lower, so we tried to publish something. And now the publishing house is working on resources for younger ages than that, which is basically
at-home parents
and children, not some kind of a classroom setting for the 2-year-old or something like that. So there is something available now. It's brand new. I don't even know what it's called, but it's kind of a story.
You know, in the church, talking about the bishops and the church in large, mm-hmm. Well, you know, we had that same thing. We had a fourth grade communion, early communion, not first, mm-hmm. Early communion. And then the parents would come to me and ask me about it earlier, and I said, fine. Nurse a child and teach a child. So there was people at 3 years old taking communion, 5 years old taking communion, and we had early communion. But now the parish that I resigned from now is struggling because the people have said that they want it earlier rather than the church council seeing it as earlier. The people have said they want it earlier. And but I'm more interested in that material for younger children for the parents. See, I appreciate Westerhoff. Years ago I heard Westerhoff say that the first time a child desires a communion, you stop the communion service and you say, Karen desires communion today. Let's celebrate this moment. And the whole congregation celebrates the moment. And then the parents had material. or something, which can teach your child about what this meaning is. So it's not a minister, you know, pastoral, you know, clergy function. Right. It's a family function.
Right. Most of the materials are geared to family use. Not
Yeah. Say, I celebrate that. If we could do that, celebrate the first time.
Our pastor came over when we joined the church on Arrows 2. Mm-hmm. Anybody, it's really up to the parent. But we asked him to come over and talk to her about it, and he simply said, make a manger in your hand, and I'm going to put Jesus there, and he's for you.
Amazing.
Blew me away, because now she says, is it time for Jesus, you know, in the service?
Most little kids have a more understanding of community than I do. I mean, mm-hmm. They really do, so I'm not worried about that. And so they put out their little hands, they know what's going on. They really do. So now congregations have to make their decision about that. There are some materials available to help congregations study the issue of the age of communion, whatever that should be. It doesn't give any answers, but it helps study the issues and let you know where the church is coming from. And you can call up our office and get thousands of copies of these documents. Just give us a call if you're interested in that. We also have a new video coming out on sacramental practices. Mm. We're still working on it now, but it should be ready by the fall. Mm. It'll be meant used by adult study groups. So there'll be a section on Eucharist and a section on baptism. And we've been filming at 5 or 6 different churches around the country and doing interviews with people. And so it should be a really good.
What's the purpose of the, what's the purpose of that video? Well,
to teach about worship, or to get people to think about the worship.
The sacraments or worship?
Yeah. Well, worship in general, word and sign, and baptism. Hmm. We've been trying to make more and more videos, trying to get with them.
Sometimes it's helpful with people too, who are coming from one tradition into another. I mean, I was raised American Baptist, and I joined Lutheran Church about a year ago. So,
it's good for new members.
I've been around the Lutheran sort of, tradition and all of that for a while. Right. When I went to college at a Lutheran school, but I just didn't know a lot of the specifics, and that would have been nice to have as an adult.
People are used to watching videos.
It's become a cultural phenomenon.
The old Oxford Workers Communion video where this 5-year-old is asked, why should you have a sacrament? He says, because I need it. I mean, it's just a really priceless time, and it opens up lots and lots of discussion.
It's really a good meeting.
So keep making the videos.
Yeah. This one should be really good.
Have you made any studies on whether these children that take communion at a very early age grow up to be heathens or Christians?
It's such a new lower.
Can't be any worse than the others.
Yeah, they have a lot of competition for being evil.
You all should know there's going to be a conference in November in Orlando, Florida, and I think we're advertising it as the future of Lutheran worship, ? It's the first official conversation that we are having about what will follow the Lutheran Book of Worship. And no one knows what that will be, and we're going to talk about not necessarily what should replace the book. You don't want to get the cart ahead of the horse. So we're going to talk about the new millennium coming. And what does that mean for the society? What does it mean for the church? And what might it mean for worship in terms of the future?
Are you wearing Kevlar for that?
So we're doing issues. What do we need to be concerned about as we think about worship in the next century? And then once we get the issues that people think need to be dealt with, then we can start talking about resources and what kind of process and what kind of format this thing or whatever it is will be. But we're not going to talk about the next cover of the book or anything like that. We don't even know if it'll be a book. We don't know. No one knows anything, but we're going to start talking. The church council has authorized us to begin these deliberations. They don't want to scare people into tossing their green books into the fire. Yeah, but any process, if it does become a book, usually a book of that size or what have you will take anywhere from 7 to 10 years to develop, so don't get too, you know, it's not something that's going to be dropping, you know, anytime soon. But so we've got all these supplements, the tide is over, we've got with my boys, and we're going to have a contemporary hymnal, whatever it's going to be called, next year, the African American one, we've got the Spanish one, and we've got all these supplements out there, so that'll keep people, the freshness going until we can decide what it is we're going to be next.
So it's going to be a contemporary hymnal?
Yeah, I'm just calling it that because I don't know what that is. Basically, religious music and a pop rock, to me, a pop rock, kind of Amy Grant, Sandy Fett, you know, that's whatever that genre of literature you want to call it. I don't even know what to call it. I call it pop rock.
And that's due out in April?
May. And it doesn't have a title yet, so I can't call it.
I'm going to talk to you after you're in the Church of Joy.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see what's going on at the Church of Joy.
Well, it's really
interesting. It's a big church.
Yeah, it's growing. My father-in-law and mother-in-law live down in that area. Mm-hmm. She hates it and he loves it.
Oh, yeah.
He's 87 and she's...
Oh, it's the kind of church that you either love it or you hate it. Yeah. It's a lightning rod. It should be interesting.
That's a mega church.
It's a mega church. It's our big mega church. So.
Is it many churches? Is it any church at all or not?
Well, it's. I don't even know how big it is these days, but it's. I don't think it's our largest congregation. I think it's our third largest. We got some ones in Minnesota.
Central
Prince of Peace, Burnsville.
Mount Olive.
Yeah, there's some other big ones too.
How big is
Church of Joy is going to overtake them pretty soon. It's pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
There's a church out in, I think we've got one in Las Vegas someplace that I'd love to go to. I think first community, is it Las Vegas or Carson? And they've got a country western service. I'm dying to get out there to see this. It's a Saturday night thing. And they draw 500 to 600 people. And they also have this a potluck and a two-step dance thing after the church service. So it's like a community.
And they started off in a lounge, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because it was closed on Sunday morning.
Yep, yep. And I remember I got a bulletin sent to our office, sent to my boss about 2 years ago. Somebody from out there sent us a bulletin from this church and said, "Dear Dr. Nelson, who's our director for worship, is this bulletin Lutheran?" From a concerned parishioner at the church. And we looked at this bulletin and we started laughing. I mean, it was a basic LBW service. But all the hymns were kind of basically revivalist music, you know. And they played it with a country band, and everybody was wearing hats and boots, and it was all twangy and everything. But it was basically an LBW service with Southern or revivalist, you know, in the garden, and you know, and Shall We Gather? I mean, it's just typical revivalist kind of music. But the way they played it, and they had a band, and they were really informal, and they had the two-stepping, and all that made a country service. And I said, there's nothing wrong with that. Just the style of music, that's all.
Plan to have a follow-up book for With One Voice?
Well, there may be a With One Voice, too. I don't know. We gave this book a shelf life of 5 years when we designed it. We said it should last about 5 years. So it's like, came out in 95. Well. It's like 3 years old already. So I don't know. We just have to take the post.
It's not being planned right now.
Not right now, but it could be done. Not too much difficulty.
It's a good.
But I think we're at the point now where people are getting overloaded with hymnals.
Hard to choose which one is the best.
And then a lot of congregations are doing copyright licensing things and two or three licenses from, you know, GIA and CCLI and licensing and all these things. And there's so many resources now. I think we need to get back to planning and basic fundamentals. I mean, you can only use so many resources. If you don't know how to use them, that's a bigger problem. Because there's plenty of things to buy, not just from our church. I mean, the Presbyterian Church has some of the best worship. I love to have the Presbyterian Book of Worship in my pew, if I could pick my worship book. And I'm so glad we're in full fellowship now, so we can shamelessly steal Presbyterian Book of Common Worship, which is the state of the art as worship books go these days. There's so many things to choose from.
How do you determine whether something is music or not?
I think that's a congregational decision. It's a cultural decision. It's also a theological decision. We don't police taste. that are awful. You know, people think we do. We have no preferred style of music that we are either for or against, because we're not in the style business. We're in the content business. We will look at something and we'll judge it based on its lyrics or how it's put together and whether or not it fits with Lutheran theology and tradition, not whether we like, you know, everybody likes different kinds of music, you know. That's a congregational decision. And it's a cultural one as well.
Well, I knew this Italian. He told me that the head opera, he lived in Italy, and the opera decided to try out this American musician. I don't know his name, but Eddie Cantor is one of those old-time song people, and he got him over there, and he got up to sing. They booed him off the strip, off the stage. Couldn't stand him.
Yeah.
He was one of the most, at that time, he was the most famous singer in the United States, but they booed him off the stage.
Right. So I hope we're getting off of our style fascination, because once we have books out in every style possible, then no, people cannot hide behind the style issue. I see a lot of false attention going to the style question, which is taking valuable energy away from the real evangelical task, as far as I'm concerned, which is, to me, I mean, the evangelism people will tell you, I mean, even though you get off on this contemporary, this or that, what brings people to church is people. People come to church because they're invited by other Christians. 80% of people that join churches join because a friend, relation, acquaintance brought them to a church and they had a warm experience. And that's, you can't pin that down to any one component of a worship service. You need to have good music, you need to have good preaching, you need to have good people who are open. You know, it's just, there's no one silver bullet. And people have gotten on this musical thing as a silver bullet, but with all silver bullets, they'll figure out that it's not really the silver bullet. The silver bullet is outreach, and it's people. And I think we as Lutherans or mainline Christians have a lot to learn about outreach. Discipleship, bringing people, you know, if each one of us would, you know, we have these bring a friend Sundays, but that's not the point. I mean, we should get rid of all this bring a friend. It's the job of every Christian to evangelize and to bring people with them to service, and it's not just a one Sunday thing. If we all did that, you know, it's just, that's where it's at. That's what brings people to church, brings other people.
Can I ask a question in a different direction?
Yeah.
Mark and Don.
Yeah, Mark
wrote the article in the Lutheran a while back.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's just an opinion. As I read the article, it's talking about churches shouldn't have multiplication of services. You should have one service. It shouldn't be contemporary. It should be this, because it's bringing the community together. Where would you and Paul Hansen come out on that?
Well, I can't tell a congregation how many services to have. I mean,
no, but theologically, what she's talking about is that. Is that, yeah.
Let's say if you have multiple, I think some congregations get to a certain size, it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Unless they would start building their sanctuaries to house thousands, which if they think they want, like if the Church of Joy wanted to build a congregation that held, you know, 6,000 people and have one service, they could do it. But you almost have to plan your building. If you want it, people keep coming, and if they're hanging from the rafters, you either have to build a new building or you divide them up into different services. So I think ideally having a community around a single service would be ideal, because then you have one community. I mean, it's not a law, it's just in terms of human relationships. People are in community with the people they're in community with. And I went to a church in the suburbs when I was in college, and they had three services. And basically, I belonged to congregation number one.
Right.
Which is at 8:30.
Right.
And those other people who went to different services, I thought they were nice, but I didn't really know anything about them. You know, I didn't have any contact with them, but technically we were part of the same church. But really, the people that were my congregation were the people at the 8:30 service. So you can say you have one church, and if that's important, and you really have three, maybe that's just the way it is. But there is something to one community. You know, if you want to have one community, you have to build a bigger sanctuary. Or you have to split off of the, some of the big churches are splitting themselves off, you know, it's a mission start. So they get to a certain plateau, they want, instead of adding two or three more services, they'll just take half the congregation and say, go off and plant a new church.
Okay.
I mean, there's no official answer. Every congregation has to decide that. But there's pitfalls with multiplicity as opposed to a single service. And the other way around, too. Because then if you have one service in one congregation, then you have to make sure that everybody in that service, you know, it's for everybody. And I think it's harder work to have a single liturgy.
But it is impossible.
I don't want to say it's harder work. It's a harder planning task. But it's harder physical work to have three or four services. So it's hard work either way.
And the culture is saying you can have what you want.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And even churches, I think Church of Joy has gotten away from this menu service option. And that's one of our largest churches. They used to have service. This is the contemporary. This is the traditional. This is the, they had one for Generation X that was different than even the contemporary. Then they've gotten rid of all those, and they're all what are called blended services. So it's the same service. They have it four or five times, and it has music from different traditions, which to me is normal. I mean, that's what, to me, that's what we're supposed to be doing. I mean, you can't raise Christians on potatoes only or spinach only, even though spinach is good and potatoes are good. It's like having a diet of one style of music. To me, it's robbing Christians of the wide range available from all times and all places and all cultures. Just because I'm African American doesn't mean I want to sing gospel music all the time. I like singing Spanish music. I was raised with German chorales, and that's part of my heritage. I like pop rock. I like a lot of things, and I feel like I should be exposed to it all. You know, why should I have to settle for a narrow view of the Christian tradition through one stylistic genre? And that's going to form me as a whole Christian. It may for a year or two, but then I'm going to be a person. I'm going to want to look for something a little bit more diverse.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are we out of time?
Okay.
Thank you all for
talking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.